Thank you for joining us for our 2020 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni, and given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so in this virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer a CLE polling question. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling question. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling question. We invite you to participate in today's session by using the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers or for any technical assistance. If the speakers are unable to answer your question during the live presentation, they will reach out directly after the program. Please visit www.bli.polsinelli.com for additional information, including CLE application statuses, a detailed view of this year's schedule, and more. We look forward to connecting with you throughout the summer and coming back together in person next year. I'd now like to pass it over to my colleagues to kick off today's program.
Well, hello there, and thank you all again for joining us today. My name is Jan Gilbert. I am a shareholder here at Polsinelli, and I will be talking today along with my colleague, Diana Villemonet, on the subject of supply chain management for 2020 and beyond. And what we'll be talking about today, a variety of topics, but simply by way of introduction at the outset here, Diane and I have both been focusing our practice exclusively on franchise and supply chain issues for a number of years. I've been doing this for over 30 years, Diana, over a dozen. And we're more than happy to be joining you today. The subjects of today's discussion, and I will move the slides here to assist, are really what is a supply chain, the overall kind of overview, the objectives of managing and organizing a supply chain, the various structures that can be implemented, the types of legal issues that come up and agreements that you'll need in order to facilitate the supply chain, management issues, dealing with the COVID-19 and current events, if you will, and managing many of the risks that come up inherent in dealing with supply chains. There are a couple of broad themes we're going to touch on, and I wanted to kind of raise those initially here so that you really can keep those in mind as we move forward. First is prior planning is going to be critical when organizing a supply chain. There are a whole lot of moving parts, a whole lot of different parties that are involved, and to plan that out ahead of time, both from a legal and an operational standpoint, is absolutely critical. The other is you really will need to involve all the participants in the supply chain to one degree or another to make it effective. And third, multiple areas of business and legal expertise are necessary. We're really dealing with the convergence of a whole lot of different skill sets and different issues. And it's rare that any single person can handle all this sort of thing. So keeping that in mind is absolutely critical from the outset. So with that in mind, what are we talking about today? What is a supply chain? Well, at its most basic, a supply chain really is the means by which a company brings products or services to market. It could cover anything from the beginning of the step, which of the process of manufacturing. We're talking about product development and design to manufacturing or development, all the way through to production, sourcing, logistics, information systems, all the way through to the end user potentially. It includes various participants, such as the manufacturers, the suppliers, the distributors, the customers, and everyone in between. We typically think of it is really in two buckets or two main components, the first being the purchasing phase, the upstream, if you will, and then the distribution stage, which is more the downstream. And with that in mind, I'll let Diana jump in and talk about some of the objectives of supply chain.
Thanks, Jan. So I think now more than ever, companies need to be planning longer-term strategies for supply chain management, and this includes large, medium, and small businesses. Many, if not most, businesses were not, frankly, prepared for COVID-19, particularly with the uncertainty as to how long this pandemic will disrupt elements of the typical supply chain, rather, including things such as raw material sourcing, manufacturing and production, packing and shipping. While each company is unique and will have its own primary objectives for improving or reviewing their supply chain management strategies, there are, I think, common objectives across the board, including the following: to supply uniform goods or services consistently meeting the company's standards and specifications, to deliver those goods or services on a timely basis and in the requisite quantities to customers, to potentially positively impact on a long-term and maybe immediate short-term the company's financial returns without requiring increased sales or even a significant investment of capital. Another objective, a common one, is to help streamline the supply chain by consolidating resources. So, for example, that would be things like eliminating redundancies in the supply chain, including overlapping supply sources, transportation costs, and unnecessary or redundant technologies. This point is particularly poignant or pertinent now while living and trying to do business in the environment of a global pandemic. Companies have, I think, at this point, largely grown accustomed to managing supply chain disruptions related to things such as cyber attacks or natural disasters and political upheaval. But before 2020, those types of disruptions were happening approximately every 3.7 years and weren't necessarily happening right on top of each other as we're seeing right now. COVID-19 has really forced companies to have to look at building these types of redundancies, having redundant suppliers and transportation networks, and keeping larger inventories, for example. A few other objectives that are common among companies when they're thinking about their supply chain management strategies, really important to think about ways to improve performance and customer satisfaction. And then last, but certainly not least, to have reliable methods in place to track goods. For example, being able to improve the digital technology to help better track products moving through the supply chain. This is really good, for example, when there are issues such as food product recalls, being able to identify where in the supply the product is and being able to yank it out pretty quickly. And then for other issues such as to avoid loss or shrinkage. So we can't talk about supply chain management strategies without discussing a few examples of a few structures or arrangements that we typically see. A few of the more common ones include a traditional buy-sell or supply arrangement. What we mean with this one, or what we mean here, is when a supplier of goods or services and a purchaser for the sale and for the ultimate resale of those goods ultimately deliver them to a distributor or some reseller or the ultimate consumer. We do a lot of work with distribution arrangements between a supplier or authorized purchaser and a reseller to purchase goods and resell and distribute them to retail outlets or individual customers. In these scenarios, once the agreements and arrangements, we typically deal with a distributor serving as the intermediary between the supplier and the retail outlet. And in the scenarios or arrangements we typically advise on, the distributor is usually procuring pallets in bulk inventory from those suppliers, shipping them, having them shipped to the distributor's distribution center, and then that inventory is broken down to case size and then ultimately distributed to the applicable retail outlets or the consumers. Joint purchasing arrangements, it's an arrangement that can be carried out in many forms. We've seen them in many forms. A typical one is where via a jointly controlled company, a company in which many other companies hold non-controlling interest or some looser form of cooperation. We deal a lot with purchasing co-ops, That's member-owned, member-controlled businesses devoted exclusively to purchasing and other related supply chain issues that distribute benefits to members on the basis of their use or control of the co-op. And we also deal with shared services agreements or arrangements. That's the model for delivering corporate support primarily, and it can work by consolidating and combining services between business units. What these latter three structures or arrangements, joint purchasing arrangements, co-ops, and shared services, the ultimate goal is to help consolidate multiple parties with a shared desire for certain goods and services. That helps to create buyer power, which can lead to lower prices or better quality products or services across the board. If done properly, these structures can help lead to large efficiency gains. What we mean here is through economies of scale or scope. These arrangements help to place and intensify supply competition if done right. And frankly, larger buying groups, in my experience, tend to see or have better negotiating position or get better prices from the suppliers. The role we typically play in connection with these arrangements is to prepare and negotiate them and prepare them in the form of various agreements used in the supply chain, which I'll turn back to Jan to discuss.
Thank you. Well, with respect to the agreements, important thing to remember is that every participant in the chain is typically subject to a contract that addresses their key functions, their responsibilities, and so forth. We've listed here a bunch of the agreements that are typically entered into. Some of them are somewhat intuitive, others may be a little less so. It kind of starts with the purchase or product supply agreements. This is that upstream, if you will, element of the supply chain. It may cover things like design, standards and specifications. It often entails projecting demand for a particular resource, a good or a service. It'd be payment terms, changes in commodity costs. So if the input costs go up or go down or goods become scarce, that all should be addressed, as well as demand changes and supply changes for the products. Distribution agreements is the downstream. The customers, others who are going to take over the products or take possession, purchase them from your organization. Among the other agreements that come up, confidentiality tends to be critical, really in any type of business. At first glance, one might think, well, if I'm simply buying, you know, hamburger meat, why is that confidential? What about it might be confidential? Well, a few things could be confidential. The customers may be confidential. The identity of the vendors, the orders and the needs, the demand within your particular organization may be the sort of thing that you wouldn't want your competitors to know about. It might give them a bit of an advantage. Oftentimes, the supply chain acts in anticipation of demand or anticipation of advertising campaigns. These are the sort of things that this information permeates through the supply chain, and the idea is you want to contain it, keep it within that so that a competitor doesn't know, okay, you're going to be promoting a particular item or you're now sourcing from this vendor so that they couldn't piggyback off of that or try to get an advantage as a result. We talked about the shared services agreements. There are vendor agreements for a number of service providers to the network, including transportation services, IT services, electronic data exchanges, inventory controls. Those sorts of elements all need to be memorialized in an agreement. And that is the sort of thing that happens just about every day as far as when we prepare these sort of arrangements and we structure them, thinking through from beginning to end, who are their participants, what are the roles, and what can and might be necessary to protect as far as information and building in some degree of anticipation of problems that may occur so we can address them sooner rather than later and preferably have a mechanism in the agreement to identify issues and address them. With that in mind, we'll talk about some of the more typical issues that come up when managing these arrangements. And I will hand it off to Diana on this one.
So if there's another takeaway or one of the main takeaways we think you, or we would hope that you would take away from our presentation is that managing the supply chain is and can be a complex undertaking requiring different areas of expertise. So the goal, the ultimate goal is to be able, and again, it's largely different by economies, is to be able to build and maintain a strong but agile supply chain, be able to plan, have a supply chain plan and execute on that plan all the time. We want to be able to innovate and scale faster, source raw materials and components, make them, deliver them, and return them, and do them, and do this flawlessly. But there are issues, and the typical issues that we see or have experienced generally have to do with a few of these areas, which again require different areas of expertise to really understand them and get a grapple on them and be able to map out different strategies for handling any chinks in the armor of the supply chain, so to speak. One of the main ones is information technology. It's the vital organ of supply chain management. Technologies are making very fast advancements. New products are being introduced within a fraction of a second, increasing their demand in the market, and having the technology in place to be able to get them to customers is really important. We've seen issues for clients with, making sure, I think one problem that we've, a common problem is making sure that they have the right technology and they're making sure to adopt operational tech based on the company's core offerings. That's an issue we see. E-commerce, the broad range of tools and techniques that are available used to conduct business in our very paperless environment at this point, including issues with respect to electronic data exchange, barcoding, these systems can fail and they can be hacked. So it's important to make sure you have the IT infrastructure in place to protect about to protect against hacking issues or major failures. Another issue is we typically deal with are export-import issues. Depending on the type of product to be imported into one country or exported to another, a company may need to devote significant attention to addressing import and export requirements. I cannot underscore how overlooked this can be, particularly now in the landscape of import and export of PPE. Here in the U.S., a broad array of U.S. laws impact the importation of products. Certain products, such as food products, may be subject to regulation by multiple federal agencies and subject to complex regulation. So companies really need to consider whether products are subject to any such restrictions and make sure they're working with their advisors before they're signing agreements to purchase those products and bring them into the U.S. or export them. There are, you may also need to consider other issues, such as whether there may be U.S. EPA or other hazardous material import prohibitions or requirements that can apply. And again, these are issues that we typically see a lot. Inspections are an integral part of the supply chain, from the manufacturing process for receipt of raw materials, production, goods issue, transportation, warehousing, and delivery to the customer. It's important to be able to have in that supply chain plan mechanisms in place to know when products are, when expenditures are happening. One product, that, one issue that we typically see is with respect to some of the suppliers not having appropriate language or provisions and agreements with those suppliers governing when those inspections are, can take place in the manner and format that those inspections should be taking place. And again, any holdups with respect to inspections can prevent those products from quickly getting out of the door of the manufacturing facility into the customer's hands. Products are also commonly subject to country of origin labeling requirements, such as consumer electronics. I've seen this issue happen a lot in the retail sector with respect to labeling of clothing items. So again, can't underscore enough that these are issues that come up, but sometimes are overdressed or overlooked in the haste to sort of get agreements done and get products into the hands of customers. So what Chan's going to talk about next are sort of different ways that you can help manage some of these issues.
Yeah, let me address that. We're talking here about more business issues than legal issues. We'll get to legal issues in a moment, but this is really the business end of it, and it involves again planning and bringing the business people into the equation to anticipate problems and to build in a mechanism to address them. The sort of things that come up are planning for new or different products or service offerings that may occur down the road. And by way of example, a number of years ago, it got a little bit of press when McDonald's went into Russia when they opened their first location in Moscow. The planning that went into that was tremendous. One of the obstacles that they faced was they had to ensure a consistent supply of product, in this particular instance, potatoes, to the store so that the French fries can be made. And they found that one of the big problems that had to be addressed before the store could open was simply getting potatoes from the farmers to the store. And there were not roads in place in many, not paved roads in place in many of the communities that were growing the potatoes. That all was addressed ahead of time and it went off relatively well. But that's not the sort of thing you'd experience every day, but it's something that you might not anticipate beforehand. What sort of problems can occur? And if we're dealing with different markets, different countries, different economies, are there different norms, different practices, and different expectations that need to be taken into account? Other things to consider, product shortages and delays. This tends to happen with some regularity, and you'll want to look to address it ahead of time through planning. What sort of mechanisms? We'll discuss a few of them, but it could be developing alternative sources for various products, building redundancies into the system, perhaps warehousing a certain amount of product, notwithstanding the desire for just-in-time delivery. When you go upstream, it may be more necessary to have something along those lines. Logistics comes into play if we're talking about anticipating ahead of time, looking at whether there's a seasonality or whether there is going to be an increased demand, either because it's generated through advertising and promotion or through outside sources. So you might want to look at past history of needs for the various items. Why? Because you're likely going to have to project what your needs are to upstream to the manufacturer or to the supplier. Typically, these agreements have within them a mechanism where the purchaser, often our client or company, will provide regular projections to the vendor, and the vendor will commit to being able to meet a certain percentage of the projections, assuming the projections are within a certain set of parameters and are communicated in advance within an agreed time frame. You're also going to have to adopt flexibility with respect to standards, and it may be that there are alternatives for certain items, and you can pivot in that respect or find alternative sources if there's a shortage or a disruption in the supply chain. We talked about shared services agreements that could consolidate resources and lead to considerable cost savings and things like shipping, information technology. The thing to keep in mind there is, at least from the legal end, I know we're talking about business issues here, but there are antitrust issues that could come up if competitors are sharing services and sharing information that may impact pricing or markets. Other critical issue is maintain open channels of communication up and down the supply chain. We try to build in mechanisms in the contract to do that, where there might be regular meetings and communications, but it's much deeper than that. It might be real-time computer access so that at any given point in time, you can see exactly how much product is where and track it and be able to make decisions based upon that. There may be points of contact along the chain that need to communicate on a much more regular basis. Those, again, are the sort of things that need to be addressed. What often occurs here is there is not an off-the-rack sort of approach to this. Each supply chain is a little bit different. It has to reflect the needs and the desires and demands of the individual participants. So they are kind of custom made, but there are common threads that run through them. Other things to keep in mind are engaging in supply chain and IT risk assessment and planning. This is the issue of the computer hack or the computer crash that may occur to deal with disruptions. Another method is the strategic stockpile planning or moving resources to anticipate demand. I know that Walmart and Home Depot are famous for doing this when it comes to predicting weather patterns and hurricanes and moving product to where it's needed, so that if there's going to be a hurricane in Florida in 5 days, these companies may be moving batteries and flashlights and other items to those markets because they're anticipating the higher demand. So that is something that can be factored in. Weather may not affect your business as much in particular, but anticipating the glitches, if you will, and being able to plan in advance for those is critical. Other thing to keep in mind is just up and down the supply chain, making sure all the participants are on the same page. They know what's expected of them. They know what the standards are, and they're educated on that, and they're trained appropriately. That's internal and external. And again, it's something that must be done and planned in advance.
We've talked about COVID a little already. I think the main point that needs to be made here is that while it appears that operations have picked up again across many industries and manufacturers and suppliers like Clorox manufacturer are working to meet current demands, the uncertainty surrounding the current pandemic suggests that the disruptions are likely going to continue or will increase into the fall and maybe even 2021. So again, the pandemic really has forced companies to reevaluate their supply chains and think about ways to help meet the objectives we discussed earlier while having the flexibility to meet customer demand while navigating the challenges of things such as labor shortages, supply shortages, and other logistical challenges. Earlier this year, I remember talking to one of our pharmaceutical supply clients, and the main purchasing officer was on the phone right before he was on the phone with me, trying to figure out how to move their main source of supply from a place called Wuhan, China, where they were getting a lot of their pharma supplies, and was trying to figure out how to get it from Wuhan to India, and had figured out a strategy, and then the Indian government said, stop, put the brakes on that. We need to keep all of that in-house because we can't have you sending all these critical supplies outside of our very large country. So it is important to really try to think about map your plans and think about ways to build in those redundancies that we've talked about earlier. Another strategy that our clients have explored is near sourcing. Again, bringing some of that manufacture, some of that supply closer to the U.S. in spots that can be a little bit more reliable, or at least having that redundancy in place in the event things are to happen with the main source of supply. Another strategy has been outsourcing the tracking technology. With the company with limited resources to do all that tracking in-house, there are companies that are doing a great job right now helping to do some of that tracking. And companies are also reviewing their contracts to deal with disputes with suppliers and vendors and want to know more about how to manage some of these risks from a legal perspective.
Let's talk a little bit about managing those risks, both from the legal and the business perspective, what it is we can build into the supply chain to address situations when there are problems. A few sort of arrows in the quiver here. One is a force majeure clause, an act of God clause, if you will, that might relieve a party of performance or delay performance in the event there is a circumstance that is beyond that party's control. It might be weather-related. It might be a pandemic like COVID-19. It might be earthquakes. It might be civil unrest or strikes, those sort of things. And these are typical in agreements. And what's normally done is a party is relieved of performance, doesn't have to perform and can delay their performance. If these events occur, typically they would have to notify the other party or parties once the event occurs before they can invoke the provision, which makes sense, so the other party has some notice and a bit of a heads up and can potentially plan for the disruption or knows that the disruption is occurring. Another arrow is alternative supply rights. If a party is unable to supply the full amount of the product and to do it in a timely manner, there may be a mechanism that would permit you to go to an alternative source, to in essence cover, which is a legal term. Go to another source and get the same product. In the agreement, we'll build in what the triggering events or conditions are, what sort of availability or delays are necessary, whether there's a pricing issue that might trigger the ability to go to other sources. This is a matter of right in the agreement, and it's simply a matter of drafting it to address these issues and assessing in advance what those triggering events would be. The next one, the age-old sort of insurance coverage, insurance for lost or damaged product, which happens with some regularity, that can be quite effective. The issue there is who pays for insurance. It's often the party who is able to get it at the best cost or better able to prevent the loss from occurring in the first place. You want to put it on the party who might be in that position, because that would therefore be an incentive for them to take appropriate steps to prevent the damage from occurring in the first place. There are other contractual defenses, if you will, to performance. These are state law issues, typically in the U.S., impossibility of performance and frustration of purpose, and those would have to be looked at on a case-by-case or state-by-state basis. With that in mind, I think we're going to jump to a polling question, and I will hand it over to Ashley.
Yes, thank you. This is the first CLE polling question for today's program. You must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. The COVID-19 pandemic has negatively impacted some supply chains. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your browser to submit. Again, the COVID-19 pandemic has negatively impacted some supply chains. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you are having issues submitting, please email events@pulsinelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another 30 seconds. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the slides box. Again, if you are having issues hitting submit, please email events@pulsinelli.com. Give you guys another 10 seconds. Great. Thank you. I'll pass it back to Diana.
Thank you, Ashley. So we want to thank you all for your questions, which we have been receiving in the Q&A box. In the interest of time and because our colleagues, Phil and Sarah, have some great things to talk to you in connection with the COVID-19 stimulus program, we have received those questions and we will respond to them via email. So with that, Jan and I would like to thank you for your participation in our program today. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email us or contact us via the contact information on the slide in front of you. So next up is Phil and Sarah.
Thank you very much, Diana. That was a great presentation. We're going to turn now to the stimulus package. In particular, we're going to focus on the PPP program. Sarah and I have been handling that for the firm since it came out in the end of March, and have been giving, hopefully you've had an opportunity to join some of our webinars. We've been giving webinars probably on a weekly or biweekly basis on new topics that have come up, and we just want to bring you up to speed of what's going on now. And you're probably wondering and saying, why are you talking about that? That program ended. You can't apply for loans anymore. And Sarah, you want to quickly talk about why everyone should probably be listening to this, regardless of whether they got a PPP loan?
Sure. So the PPP is going to have an impact for a couple of years. The first reason is that the SBA has the right to audit any borrower for a period of up to 6 years after the end of their covered period. So we could see SBA audits, you know, for the next 6 years if the SBA wants to continue those audits. So that's one thing. And the second is that the SBA has come out and said that changes in ownership within the 12 months of the final disbursement of the PPP loan will need SBA approval. So we don't have particular guidance on what that means with respect to forgiveness, but it's possible that those of you who are entering into any M&A transactions within the next year may need SBA approval if either you or the target have received a PPP loan.
So basically the caution there is if you're doing a transaction, whether it's M&A, purchase of assets, you want to think about and find out early whether the target in the transaction received a PPP loan, even if they've paid it off already, and deal with it. And we'll talk about in a moment how to do that. But first, let me just spend a minute or two talking about how we got where we are and what happened real quickly. So at the end of March, with the original CARES Act, the CARES Act 1.0, there was $300 billion that was allocated to the PPP program, and it kind of was a little bit like the Wild West. All of a sudden, people were figuring out, how do I apply for it? Do I qualify for it? And the big issue there was that the U.S. Treasury Department and the SBA were tasked to administer this program. People started applying for the loans. The entire amount was allocated fairly quickly, and there were no regulations related to this program. The only law that was being made were through FAQs, which were being put out first separately from the Treasury Department and the SBA, and then collectively they finally got together and put them out on their own. And those FAQs are actually really the biggest part of determining what's going on with this program. Then shortly after it happened, the SBA and the Treasury Department came out and said, because of some of the folks who were getting loans, wait a second, you have to demonstrate need if you're getting loans. Well, so all of a sudden everybody decided, do I have to give the loan back? If I didn't have need, should I give it back? And there was a time period where you could give it back and at no fault, and folks started wondering, should I do that? There are potential criminal implications if I don't do that. And then the SBA came out and said, no, there won't be criminal implications, but we could force you in the future during an audit to pay the money back. So everybody who started thinking about giving the loan back started thinking, maybe I should keep the loan. They issued another $300 billion or so of loans or commitment to making loans. And there was this second round that went through. Additional FAQs were put into place. And that kind of brings us to the end of last week, where the deadline for applying for loans has passed, and we're currently where we are. So let me stop there. I want to bring you up to date on what are the current state of what's going on in Congress with respect to continuing the program. But this was originally designed as a update in Washington. But Sarah, I would say within the last hour or so, we had a different kind of update in Washington, just to see the type of things that can happen with these PPP loans. Do you want to talk about that real quickly?
Sure. So today the DOJ came out with a prosecution for against a man living in D.C. for defrauding the PPP and EIDL programs of $2 million. This man purchased a row house, he purchased a sports sedan, and a yacht. And so this is in line with the type of enforcement actions that we've seen in PPP. It's really people who've taken the money and then are not using it for proper uses and may have misrepresented the business that they had in the first place. So those are kind of the big criminal proceedings that we've seen for this program.
So while that it's somewhat humorous in what this person did, the point about this is that when people applied for these loans and file with the government, they're signing certifications, and the SBA has audit function over them. The Treasury Department has audit function, and then they can submit anything they want to the DOJ and refer it if they think what's going on is criminal. More practical, I think the SBA is going to not refer things to the DOJ unless they're obvious fraud type of things, and try to work out any issues that may occur with respect to after the loans have been issued and what's going on. So real quickly, let me talk about the other Washington update is, what are we seeing in Congress with the programs? And there's two, there's a Senate proposal and a House proposal, neither of which have gone anywhere because the two sides aren't really talking to each other right now. But just to give you a flavor, both sides believe there should be a second round of PPP loans. Both of them believe they should open it up to folks to either be able to use it for things beyond just the original use, and the original use was mainly for payroll and certain other things like lease payments and mortgage payments and employee benefits. So the idea in both programs is to maybe open it up to cover more activities, potentially let people get a second loan, potentially open it up to smaller companies to get the second loans. In the House proposal, they would extend the payback period from 2 years to 5 years. So currently, if you don't get forgiveness on your loans, you get 2 years to pay back. Now, some people are suggesting maybe it should be a longer period of time. And then there was originally, and most SBA loans, nonprofits are not allowed to qualify for the loans, but they carved out in the PPP program 501c6s, but not other 501c organizations. So both proposals are trying to broaden that. So that's kind of where we are. That's kind of where we are today. So now let's turn and talk about the bigger issue of, what if you encounter a company that currently has a PPP loan? But before we do that, do you want to give a quick overview, Sarah, on how many loans have been given out?
Sure. So this is just a reminder that the PPP program are forgivable loans of a maximum of $10 million to go to qualified small businesses. So far, they've approved over $519 billion in loans to more than 5 million borrowers. Most of the loans are for less than $50,000, which is likely because independent contractors can apply, and so it's unlikely that many of them have more than $50,000 for 2.5 times their monthly salaries. But as you know, we kind of teed up, as borrowers get to the end of their covered period and are looking towards, you know, various business actions, there are a couple of issues that we want to flag. And Phil's going to talk about the first one, which is changes of control.
Right. So they're in the program, which is covered by the 7A SBA loan program. There has been for years a ruling that says if you have a change of control within 12 years of receiving a loan, and change of control is really defined as change of ownership and it's not defined, you need to get SBA approval before you can do it. And the reason that that's in place and the reason that's there is there was no forgiveness factor with normal traditional 7A loans. So if you went to a bank, got a 7A loan, they wanted to see why you would be having a change in ownership so quickly after receiving the loan. With the PPP program, the pandemic in place, there are a lot more organizations that, in order to stay afloat, are choosing to enter into a transaction afterward. So there's two things that you need to worry about. One is on the traditional loan documents that somebody who received in a PPP loan, the change of ownership is almost always a default in the loan, which is not necessarily problematic in and of itself. You can go to the bank and you can get them to consent to the default. Now, most banks are taking the position they'll agree to consent to it if you comply with the SBA approval requirement, and you or the borrower cannot actually get that approval from the SBA. The bank who gave you the loan has to get the approval. So you would go to the bank would then go to the SBA, and from what we're hearing from the various SBA regional offices, they want to see a copy of the documents involved in the transaction. They want to know why the transaction is occurring, and they want to know how it's going to affect employees or the original borrower. There's no specific application. They're just asking you to email all these things in. Right now, it's taking 2 to 5 to 6 weeks for these type of approvals. So a couple of takeaways from that is think about it early if you're going to be involved in a transaction, not at the very end when you're ready to close the transaction, and go to your bank early on so that you leave enough time to do this. This is becoming a due diligence issue, and it's becoming a what would be looked at as a traditional regulatory approval type of transaction, and it's at least what we've been seeing. It's slowed down some transactions that people have been involved in, and or had it take a very different tact of how the transaction is being done. Sarah?
So just to add on quickly to what Phil was just saying, the SBA does not define change of ownership, and so while we think it's very clear that if there's a change of control, that approval will be needed, change of ownership itself is not defined, so there's not a clear answer on if it's a minority ownership stake and there's a change in that, whether SBA approval is required, but we think the most conservative approach would be to still reach out to the lender and make them aware of the transaction, and they can work with the SBA. So quickly to go to the timing of a closing, with the Paycheck Eligibility Act, the covered period was extended from 8 weeks to 24 weeks. And so that extended time period makes the question of when to time a closing even more important. The reason why is that it can impact forgiveness. And the way that it could do that is kind of twofold. The first is that if you close a transaction in the middle of the covered period and the employees move from the borrower to the new owner, that borrower is going to have a full-time equivalent employee count issue. And the reason why that's impactful is that there's a proportional reduction for a reduction in full-time equivalent employees in the forgiveness amount. So if a borrower is losing employees due to a change in ownership during the covered period, that borrower is not going to be able to get full forgiveness. For the time being, our best approach would be to wait until the company or the borrower can seek forgiveness before closing. It just makes it administratively that much easier, and it also ensures that you don't have any of these reductions that might occur. We have seen closings that happen, but there's a transition period for employees to make sure that FTE count is not impacted. The other issue is if all of the employees move over, the borrower may not be able to use whatever PPP amount is left over if they're still in their covered period. It's going to be really important to think about the timing of that closing. Now, Phil's going to touch on successor liability.
Yeah, before I do that, Sarah, one question on that. You said try to wait till till you've applied for forgiveness. Can you make a distinction and talk about the difference for when you've applied versus when you find out whether you're getting forgiveness?
Sure. So with the 24-week covered period, you can apply for forgiveness as soon as you have used all the proceeds. The portal opened on Monday. However, you may not hear back about forgiveness 4 or 5 months. The reason is that the lender has 60 days to review your materials and decide whether they agree with you and send it to the SBA, and then the SBA has an additional 90 days to review before remitting forgiveness. So applying for forgiveness and receiving are going to be two different time periods, but to some extent, applying kind of puts a halt on anything related to FTEs or salary reductions, and so you have no funds left, and so it's okay to kind of move forward with the business after that application has been made.
Yeah, so how that affects a purchase agreement also is applying for the forgiveness sets in stone how much you think you'll get in forgiveness, so that the acquirer and the target or the borrower would know, okay, how much is the loan that I took out, and then how much of that loan do we think is going to be forgiven? So maybe it was a $2 million loan, but we think based on change of circumstances and qualifications, maybe only $1.5 million is forgivable. So then what the borrower or the target and the acquirer need to figure out is who's going to be responsible for that loan if you don't get the forgiveness you think you're going to get, or if you don't get any forgiveness. So in the sample I was talking about, it would be if you didn't get the $1.5 million or even the payback of the entire $2 million loan. So what we're seeing a lot of transactions, what we see happening is they're creating an escrow and they're determining whether you factor that amount into the purchase price or whether the seller only gets that amount upon forgiveness. But if there isn't forgiveness, it comes out of the seller's part of the purchase price, and they create a contractual escrow agreement or something that triggers once you find out about the forgiveness down the road. One of the problems with that is, as Sarah was saying, is that could take 5 months, and then there's that audit risk that could happen for another 6 years. So a lot of times we see the escrow for the period of time for forgiveness, and then it breaks, but then there's an indemnification if there's an audit that comes back and the audit says, no, even though you got forgiveness, there was a problem with how you handled this, and you have to pay all the money back. And so then the purchaser could potentially seek indemnification against the target if they truly didn't get forgiveness of the loan. The other thing we're seeing in the purchase agreements that we caution people to be very careful about is, one, how do you set up the transaction? Even if it's not a merger, is it a change of ownership? Even if you say, oh, I'm only going to be purchasing assets, did you de facto create a merger? Did you de facto have a change of ownership because it's not defined? And be very careful how you draft that language. And again, our caution is to say, go to the bank ahead of time and find out if they believe there's an event of default, depending on how you structured the transaction. The other thing that's important in the agreement is to have good reps and warranties and conditions, closing conditions and conditions after the fact. The reps and warranties, and we're happy to help you with those, relate to what happened when you got the loan. Did you, have the target sign on to representations that they did everything they were supposed to do? The covenants after the fact relate to applying for forgiveness and what happens if there's a subsequent audit. And I'll let Sarah talk about that.
Sure. So as I stated kind of at the outset, the SBA has the authority to audit any PPP loans for the 6 years after the covered period. However, they have stated that they will audit all PPP loans of over $2 million. And that's not just that the borrower itself obtained PPP loans of $2 million or more, it's the borrowers and its affiliates. So it is possible that a borrower that only has $150,000 in PPP loans because of the aggregation of its affiliates would have an SBA audit. So what's really important about this is that extended six-year period of maintaining documentation throughout this six-year period. That's one of the requirements when you apply for forgiveness. And what we've been telling everybody is it's better to have your ducks in a row now than scrambling to figure out what your economic need was and what your affiliation analysis was in 5 years. So PPP borrowers should make sure that they have, you know, whether it be on the cloud or on the computer, wherever, all of the documentation is in one place that can be easily accessed for the next 6 years, including if there is a change of control, that wherever the liability for that PPP flows to, that person also has all that documentation. Phil, do you want to quickly touch on forgiveness denials?
Yeah, so there is a mechanism. It's not really well documented yet. We're hoping there'll be more that comes up as there's more M&A transactions and as people apply for forgiveness. As Sarah mentioned, we're able to do that starting this past Monday. So if a lender or the SBA denies forgiveness, there's an appeal process that you can go through. The important part of that appeal process is, and I would say just based on other SBA programs, you can't assume you're going to win an appeal process. It's hard when the government makes a decision. But the important thing is to make sure you cover that in an M&A transaction to figure out what's going to happen and how you deal with that type of denial of forgiveness. So if the purchaser is taking on the risk of whether there was forgiveness or not, they're going to want the cooperation of the borrower to help them in any type of proceeding against the SBA. So we're going to talk about one other thing here real quickly, and that is you're thinking to yourself, well, I've heard about this Main Street Lending Program, and what's going to happen with that, and is that something that's available? Maybe my company was too big to get a PPP. Maybe they're interested, in something else that's still open. Well, the good news is it was extended to December 31st to be able to apply for it. The more negative news is that there are very few banks who are offering this lending program. Many banks signed up for it. There was a list that was put out, but when you actually go and talk to them, A, they only want to talk to existing customers, and B, they're not big fans of it because it's an administrative burden to go through it. And the interest from borrowers' point of view is much less than the PPP program. One, because it doesn't have that forgiveness factor, so it's a regular loan that you're getting. Two, it may not have terms that are any better than your existing loans that are in place. And three, there are restrictions in shareholder buybacks, dividends, and potential restrictions on increasing compensation while the loan is outstanding. So as of the beginning of this week, we're only aware of 8 loans that have been given under this program. I'm sure that number is going to go up. And we're not saying don't think about the program. If you're interested in it, please contact us. We think it's a program that could be okay for some people. We're actually working with some banks and some borrowers in the program. But we just wanted to point out that the interest has been pretty limited in that program. So I think, Ashley, it's time for our second bonus question here.
Yes. This is the last CLE polling question for today's program. Again, you must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. The PPP is administered by the Federal Reserve. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your browser to submit. Again, the PPP is administered by the Federal Reserve. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you are having issues submitting, please email events@polsonelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another 30 seconds. Again, select true or false and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner of that slides box. If you are having issues hitting submit, please email events@polsonelli.com. Give you guys another 15 seconds. If you are having issues, try to refresh or email events@polsonelli.com. Bill, I'll pass it back to you.
Great. So looking at the answers there, it's actually the U.S. Treasury Department and the SBA. So it's not the Federal Reserve, just so folks know. And it's a combination of the Treasury Department and the SBA working together to administer the program. At this point, I would just want to thank everybody for attending. We really appreciate the BLI and your participating in it as always. Sarah and I are available to help anyone with the issues related to this topic. You know, easiest way is to email both of us and one of us will be sure to get back to you or call us. But we know there's a lot of moving targets in this program. There's a lot of, still unanswered questions with the PPP. Hopefully today we gave you some things to think about if you encounter an issue related to it. Thank you very much.
This concludes today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling questions. Recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.